When the nation has seen mass shootings over the last few years, mental illness often enters the conversation, and improved mental health screening and treatment is offered as a possible solution.
Well, our next guest says we tend to overlook a key element in violence, and that's anger. She says we need to take anger seriously and makes the case that in our mental health system and even our daily lives, we can do a lot to deal with it better.
Laura Hayes is with us. She's a clinical psychologist in Bethesda, Maryland. A recent piece she wrote on anger is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you say that when it comes to things like mass shootings, we don't talk about anger enough. Why should anger be a bigger part of the conversation?
Well, I think that the conversation has been diverted recently in the last few years, specifically to the mentally ill, and I think that's a bit of a red herring. The statistics actually support anger being and past history of violence as being predictors, strong predictors of homicides, whereas mentally ill people commit really a very small proportion of violent crimes. There are, I think, multiple reasons for this focus. But I think we're missing the real point here, which is that people that have a history of acting out violently, people who have a history with the law, have a much higher probability of ending up doing something really dramatic and heinous.
What do you think we're missing when, as a society, we focus in on mental illness and miss the anger part of it?
Well, I think that I think there's a misattribution going on here. I think actually we could remove mental health as a part of this overall, at least diagnosed mental illnesses. When we're talking about people who have things like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, they have no greater probability of being involved in a violent crime than anyone else does. Anger, on the other hand, is a pretty pervasive issue. It's something that all of us have to deal with. It's biologically wired into us. And if it comes up inappropriately in our technological, highly densely populated, industrialized society, it's inappropriate.
Laura, before we dig deeper into anger, if we misattribute violence to people with mental illness, does that add to a stigma of people with diagnosed mental illness, make people look at them as ticking time bombs when we shouldn't?
I think that's absolutely true. And in fact, that was what led me to write this story. I have a client who has some paranoia. She's diagnosed bipolar. And she has watched this happen in the news over and over again. Essentially, I think what's happening is conversation after these terrible mass murders used to turn frequently to gun control. And the NRA is handling this really deftly, I think, so that the focus has now shifted to the mentally ill. But in a way, that's not constructive. In a way, you know, where they're being called lunatics and crazies, a lot of really hostile things are being said about them. But, you know, in terms of doing something to manage gun control with mentally ill people, it's not something that the gun control people are interested in really putting energy behind. So we're setting them up. They're getting a lot of attention. And for my patient, it was really frightening. And this did feed into some paranoia. And we had a conversation about how this overall anger piece was really being overlooked as we're talking about whether it's about guns or whether it's about mental illness. It's about anger, whether you're mentally ill or not.
How do we know when anger is normal? Because we often hear that anger is healthy and it's good to let anger out and express it. How do we know when it's that kind of anger or when it's something that is something that could become violent?
Right. That's a great question. So anger is basically a normal, healthy response that's wired into us. We have to be able to protect ourselves, and our whole nervous system is designed to flip between a more passive, relaxed state, the parasympathetic nervous system, and an action-oriented fight-or-flight state, sympathetic nervous system. We're not going to get away from that for probably quite a while. I mean, that's an evolutionary piece of us. And it works really, really well when you're facing down a wolf pack. You have to take action immediately. You can't sit around and think about it. If you don't do something fast, you're going to be dead. But when you take that in to your office and your boss comes in and says, oh, you know, I really don't think you're putting in the time you need to be putting in, and you go into fight or flight response, life or death, I need to kill or in order to survive, it's really inappropriate and dysfunctional. And most of us manage to monitor that enough so that we don't get into a whole lot of trouble. Some of us don't. Some of us have histories that haven't really taught us to do that stuff well, and we can behave in really inappropriate ways. So just very quickly, the easy case is if you have uncontrollable anger or chronic anger or irritability, if you just feel that rumbling all the time, or if when you get angry it feels really uncontrollable, or you feel like you need a drink or some drugs or something to manage it, or if you lose control of it, you become violent, you become threatening, or if other people are maybe hinting to you that perhaps you could need a little bit of help in this area. Those are pretty easy. And in fact, when someone has that problem, they usually already know it. They've already gotten in trouble and it's been drawn to their attention. But rage can also be precipitated by feelings that don't seem to be anger. For example, shame or loss or betrayal, which goes something like, my girlfriend cheated on me, so I broke all the windows in her car. You don't hear the anger in there. You can kind of think, you know, maybe we're skipping over a step there, but what you might see in this person is really the pain of being betrayed, and then the windows go out in the girlfriend's car. So it's not always that you're just looking for someone who demonstrates excessive anger. You may also see really deep sadness, crying, or an inability to take action, or you may see numbness. So this is more, I mean, it's Mental Health Month, too, so it's kind of good to kick these out here. But you may see different kinds of symptoms. You may see relationships that if someone's relationships mostly are incredibly dramatic with crying and threats and physical fighting and maybe destruction of property, that's a red flag. There's something going on underneath it that's not being managed. Or troubling thoughts of violence or of hurting someone or hurting yourself. Those are all signs that it would be a good idea probably to go and talk to someone. And then, you know, one that I really think that gets neglected is this idea of being a loner, because loners are by definition withdrawn, not socially integrated, and they're quiet. I think we often underestimate the impact of being that person, being an outsider who doesn't have a place in society, who is maybe ostracized or has been, who's been bullied, who's been mocked, and is carrying a lot of feelings about that, but they're not being expressed.
You know, I think a lot of us might think of being anger prone or not just as part of our personality, not as something we can treat or do something about. Can we really have that much control over our anger?
That's an interesting question, because I believe that the main approach to anger, the most effective approach to anger, is actually acknowledge what the experience is, acknowledge what's going on internally. So we're actually not trying to take away anybody's feelings. We're trying to make it okay to sit with the feelings that you have. So you may, in fact, feel furious about something that's happened to you in a relationship or at work, but you have a lot of choices about what you actually do about it.
Now, when you use the terminology sit with the anger, you're sort of using the language that we're starting to get used to hearing when we talk about meditation. And I wonder how you feel about that as a tool for working with anger.
Yes, that's no coincidence. I think that mindfulness is extremely useful for managing a multitude of things. That is really kind of the center of it, is to be okay, to be present, to allow your feelings to exist, to not try to censor them, to not try to hide from them, to not deny them, but to just permit them to be there. I think mindfulness is a tremendously helpful tool and a really good starting point It takes little effort to do. There are many resources where you can listen to meditation, kind of guided imagery to walk through it, so you don't even have to think about it. But it can really let you allow your feelings to become comfortable. Still, you will know, you know, I'm grieving because I lost my father. I feel really guilty about something that I did once in the past. Those feelings still are there, but they don't run you anymore.
We're talking to clinical psychologist Laura Hayes about anger, its role in leading to violence, and what we can do about it.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have ways of dealing with anger in your life? Do you meditate maybe to keep anger under control? And do you think anger is a major problem in our society, maybe one that gets overlooked, especially when we're looking at violent crime? Call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation now about anger with clinical psychologist Laura Hayes. She says we can improve our lives and our society by learning how to deal with anger.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think we have an anger problem in our society? Are we ignoring anger? Do you think it's a cause of problems, including violence? What do you do to manage anger in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to our callers now. We've got Lynette on the line in Milwaukee. Lynette, hi.
Yeah, hi. I find the conversation interesting. I personally do meditate when I'm angry or feeling upset. I do practice mindfulness. But I did want to mention, I think there's a cultural component to the perception of anger. I know that I'm an African-American woman, and I know there's this, you know, stereotype of angry black woman. And an issue came up with my niece, something at her school, where school counselor accused her of being angry, and she wasn't. She was upset, and she and I talked about it later, and we were trying to figure out, you know, is it a tone of voice? You know, I think sometimes across cultures and also maybe genders, a perception of when someone is angry and when they're just upset is interpreted differently. I don't know. It seems like that to me.
Lynette, thank you. That's very interesting. Laura, talking about the way we read each other's anger can be confusing within a cultural group, too, I think, but maybe more so between groups.
That's a really, really good point. It sounds to me like there's a judgment being made about the anger as well, and I think there are differences in how we label it, but there are cultural differences in how much you're allowed to express, how vehemently you're allowed to express something. And there are also gender differences in how much is permitted there and when it's considered to be. I think there's a huge difference in how much expression is permitted to boys and how much is permitted to girls within what we consider to be a healthy range.
So what if you feel you're being misunderstood when it comes to expressing your anger, maybe in a scenario like Lynette just described, or maybe a girl in a classroom? What is a way to confront, you know, the safety or, you know, the viability of expressing anger in a place like that?
Are you talking about specifically with an authority figure like her counselor?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, how old is her daughter?
I'm not sure. She's off the line now, but, you know, let's say a grade school kid, maybe.
Yeah. So I think what we want to do is we want to, well, this goes two directions. One is we want to be able to say to our kids, you need to be able to assert yourself. And actually, you know, one of the things that I think is really important in dealing with anger, in addition to mindfulness and a number of other things, is assertiveness training. Because a lot of anger comes out of feeling like you're vulnerable. I mean, these things, the betrayal or feeling like you're being treated unfairly, many things that we react to with rage are really about our own fear or vulnerability. So to strengthen that, to feel like we can be assertive and we can speak directly without insulting people or being inappropriate, that's a really powerful tool and actually an important part of sort of rehabilitative anger management. So, I mean, for a child, that's really important that you teach them from the beginning, you know, you can say, no, that's really not what's happening. I'm really feeling this. Stand up for yourself. You know, when you're being misunderstood, you don't need to get angry about it. You just need to tell them. And if they don't get it, they don't get it. Sometimes that's true, even if it's an adult, even if it's your teacher. But stick up for yourself. Stand by what you believe. I also believe that the mindfulness tools, the assertiveness tools, the relaxation tools, some of the cognitive process tools, all of this stuff is really pretty simple. And it's stuff that we could easily include in our curriculum. I mean, this could be a very important part of health curriculum for kids. It could be, I know a teacher who starts her class every day by having the kids close their eyes and do deep breaths, do three deep breaths before they start. And you walk into her classroom, and it's like the kids are all on benzodiazepines. I mean, it's just the relaxation is palpable when you walk in the room. So the schools should be included in this as well.
Lynette, thanks a lot for bringing up those issues. We'll go now to Josh with us in Appleton. Josh, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going? That was actually part of my question, as I was going to talk about social heredity as far as a child's upbringing and dealing with anger, I think, is one of the biggest issues in our society today. And I don't think that kids are being taught, or for that matter, adults or just people in general are being taught to replace their anger with understanding. I think if you replace your anger with understanding and trying to actually figure out what it is with the situation, instead of getting angry, if mm-hmm. you don't take something personally.
All right, Josh, I want to get Laura in on this. Are there good ways for parents to teach or maybe model good anger management for their kids?
Oh,
Laura, yeah.
Absolutely. I think that is really important. And I think, you know, there's a semantic issue here, but when you talk about replacing your anger with something else, I think for some people that can be very difficult. I mean, you're losing something that's an important part of you. That anger is actually pretty big. And I like the idea better that you accept the anger and be okay with that and then move. There is a cognitive technique that's moving from your emotional mind, which is saying, I'm really upset right now, this is really making me angry, to your wise mind, which says, you know, yeah, it's making you angry, I see that, and sort of observes it and says, okay, now what's the most effective thing that I can do right now? And that kind of thing you can teach that to your kids too. You can model it. It's like, okay, I came in and I was yelling because the neighbor, you know, cut me off, and I'm sorry for yelling at everybody, and I need to move from my emotional mind into my wise mind and show the kids you're actually living it. More than teaching it, you're living it and putting words on it, putting labels on it.
Well, thank you so much for that call, and let's go next to Joan in Williams Bay. Hey, Joan.
Hi. It's good topic.
Thank you.
I think we should talk about it often. I think people get angry when they lose sight of the choices that are available to them. If they are driving, they have to be aware that they have choices. If there's a driver that makes them angry, they have to tell themselves that they have a choice to make, like I'll turn the radio on, or I'll think about something else. You know, you've always got choices unless you're really in a dire situation.
All right. Yeah, good points, Jonah, about choosing between different responses when we get angry. Is that something that we can train ourselves to do?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a great example of being in a fight or flight mode and wanting, you know, what you want to do is you want to ram the car next to you. But what you do instead is you think to yourself, you know, I'll just listen to music. It doesn't really matter. That person doesn't matter to me. Or maybe that person has, you know, a dire emergency that they need to get to and I don't really know what's in their head. And I can let it go. Or, you know, any of a number of other things. Language is actually really helpful in this. I think talking yourself through. In a car, this works really well because you can talk out loud and you don't look like you're talking, although now with the cell phones, you can pretty much do that anyway. But talk to yourself. Talk yourself through it and say, you know, what are my choices here? Can I do something besides make myself feel worse? Can I move to a wise mind where I'm going to feel better?
Laura, you're hoping that we as a society take anger more seriously. On the mental health profession side, where does that start? How can the profession start thinking about anger?
Yeah, we're slackers on this. I completely concede that. I think that I have so much stuff that I would like to share that I know there isn't time to even talk about here. There's so many different simple techniques and skills that can be used. And what's happened in my opinion, in the opinion of many others, is that the mental health industry has kind of been co-opted by the pharmaceutical companies who, to a great extent, dictate how our diagnostic manual, the DSM, is written. And originally, back in the 50s, it was written from the perspective that there were underlying causes to mental health problems. And in the 80s, that all kind of disappeared. And there are just clusters of symptoms to which you assign particular drugs. You're bipolar, you take lithium. And it's taken us away from this more organic thinking about subtleties and nuances. You know, I can say, you know, my dad was a little bit paranoid. My mom was a little bit of a hypochondriac, and maybe not diagnosable, but an individual person with different aspects. And we're not really doing that. We're dealing in terms of medications and diagnoses for which the medications can be prescribed, and we're missing this whole other world of what's going on inside of people. So there is, I think, a trend to incorporate mindfulness. That's, you know, started to move into the culture in general and a little bit into therapy. And I think it makes us a little bit more open to, Eastern approaches to health, which is more holistic.
We'll leave it there for now. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was clinical psychologist Laura Hayes. Her recent piece on anger and violence is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.